Final case for argument this morning is 25-1804, Chitluk v. HHS. Mr. Tint, we're ready whenever you are. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Greg Tint. I'm here representing Petitioner Appellant Lawrence Chitluk. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal time. Petitioner appellant Mr. Chitluk would frame the question presented as whether a pro se petitioner who follows the rules can access justice. The facts here are undisputed, so whether equitable tolling applies here is a matter of law that this court reviews de novo. Mr. Chitluk asked this court to, as a first matter, hold that he was reasonably diligent as a matter of law, and secondly, vacate the judgment of the trial court, dismissing his petition and remand for extraordinary circumstances finding, which they didn't reach.
If we were to agree with you and remand with instruction, what is it that we would instruct the vaccine board to do?
Your Honor.
Special Master.
The remand should consider whether extraordinary circumstances conspired to make Mr. Chitluk's petition untimely.
So you're not seeking just reversal. You wouldn't have us decide the extraordinary circumstances. I mean, you want us to decide the reasonable diligence issue.
Absolutely.
With respect, you're correct. I mean, the special master did decide the extraordinary circumstances. It's just the Court of Federal Claims judge did not reach that issue.
Yes.
So do you think it's necessary for us to send it back for an analysis of the extraordinary circumstances, or is there enough in the record for us to conclude that?
Petitioner would love if you could rule on extraordinary circumstances.
So why don't we cover that? I mean, let's assume we agree somewhat with you on the reasonable diligence having been followed here because of the mailing and the timing and everything. What is the extraordinary circumstances, and how does that differ?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would point to the court's amended General Order 2, which tracked pro se petitioners to file their case initiating documents in paper, and it specified postal service, a postal service. It didn't specify a premium service over a first class service. And in the preamble to the amended general order, it says, based on declared public health emergencies and ongoing efforts to mitigate the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it explicitly talks about how the COVID-19 pandemic impacted the courts. The courts had to take action to protect staff, judges, clerks, other personnel.
But one, did you preserve that issue before the Court of Federal Claims? And two, why is that extraordinary? Isn't there an argument about forfeiture here that you didn't preserve that argument? The rules are quite clear, the 8F of the Vaccine Act, that you have to have raised it.
Your Honor, I would say, in my review of the precedent, I would say that the issues are the elements of reasonable diligence and extraordinary circumstance.
Well, are you arguing that the two kind of go hand in hand, and that everything that happened with respect to the mail system was extraordinary in terms of the delay and so forth that occurred in the circumstance?
I'm arguing that there was a confluence of circumstances. So one, the orders in view of COVID-19, whether the court wants to say COVID-19 or the pandemic was extraordinary or not, that's for the panel to decide, obviously. And also, um, court's indulgence. There is a report from the USPS, Exhibit 28, in the certified record below. It's actually not in the appendix, but it's in the certified record below from the USPS. It's a Delivering for America 10-year plan, and it said specifically that the post office was impacted by the post office operations were impacted by COVID-19. My motion to the special master, the motion for equitable tolling at appendix 65 to 66, talks about how in that report, the USPS said COVID significantly exacerbated its service. The network constraints prevented timely and consistent arrival of the mail, and that first class mail was forced into steeper decline by the pandemic.
Was there any questioning by the special master as to financial resources available, the difference between sending something by overnight courier or by U.S. Postal Service?
There was no discussion with the special master. I don't recall reading that in her decision on the motion for equitable tolling for petitioner appellant Chilik's motion for equitable tolling.
Your client was pro se at the time, right?
At the time of filing, yes, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, my question goes to, if you're a pro se client dealing with a remedial law like the Vaccine Act, that's intended, its purpose is to fund and to explore whether individuals are eligible for funding and all. And here we have a situation where you have a pro se petitioner and you have I don't know how much a UPS would have cost at that time, $20 versus, I was going to say a 35-cent stamp, but that would age me, I guess, yeah. Right? How much are stamps nowadays?
More.
But the difference between postage less than a dollar and filing something well above that, was any of that reviewed?
Your Honor, that wasn't, in my reading of the decision by the special master, it wasn't weighed. The special master's discussion of the extraordinary circumstances prong cited to cases like Ansari, Garadecki, I think that's how it's pronounced, that suggested delays in ordinary, which I was reading as first class mail service, are common and thus can never constitute an extraordinary circumstance.
I think that's right, but I think the special master was assessing the evidence and the argument that was made on Mr. Chitlick's behalf. And I didn't see anywhere that it was argued he lacked the financial resources or that finances were even a factor. It occurred to me that that could, I don't know what his situation is, but certainly the overnight mail and mailing it twice and all the photocopying twice or maybe driving from Maryland to here, that would be more of a burden. But I didn't see that argued as part of the extraordinary circumstances. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
You seemed to be arguing earlier, and I got this sense, at least from the briefing, that the extraordinary circumstances here are a confluence or a combination of a lot of different things, to include COVID and the restrictions on the court here and the delay in the mail and maybe the age and vulnerability of your client. Was that argument made to the special master or to the Court of Federal Claims? Because my concern is if it was waived, I don't know if we could, go along with that argument.
As to the extraordinary circumstances prong?
Yes. The confluence, the idea that here's what my extraordinary circumstances are. It's a combination of a bunch of things. Perhaps none of them individually would be an extraordinary circumstance, but the totality of them are. Can you show me if that argument was made below?
Your Honor, would I be able to find citations in the appendix and present during my rebuttal time? Would that be okay with you?
Well, just on that point, the special master says petitioner has not provided sufficient evidence that the COVID-19 pandemic substantially affected the meal to cause an extraordinary circumstance. So I assume somebody must have raised that issue to the special master, since the special master seems to have dealt with that.
Yes, Your Honor. I would just reply that the certified record below did include Petitioner Exhibit 28, which is a Delivering for America 10-year plan, where at page 19 of that document, it does say pretty explicitly that, the section is titled COVID-19 Impact. And I quoted before, but I can quote again.
And that document was in the record?
It was in the certified record below. Yes, Your Honor. Petitioner Exhibit 28.
Why don't we? Oh,
it's not in our record.
No, Your Honor. That was an oversight.
Okay. Why don't we hear from the other side? Mr. Williamson, good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Travis Williamson on behalf of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. I'd actually like to begin with this discussion of forfeiture versus waiver. Judge Prost, I believe you asked if there was a forfeiture problem in the record with some of these arguments related to extraordinary circumstances not being raised below. The government's position is that is correct.
They did raise below the issue of this was during COVID.
Yes.
And therefore the mail system was presumably not, in retrospect, working as well as it should have or as it could have been expected. That issue was preserved, correct?
Correct. So specifically, there are two arguments that the special master was able to consider related to extraordinary circumstances. One was that the Postal Service's failure to deliver within a 1 to 5 day delivery commitment constituted an extraordinary circumstance, and the other was a general invocation that the COVID-19 pandemic impacted their ability to deliver the mail. Below, or I should say before this court, petitioner has raised new arguments that were not preserved
and
below.
The new argument has to do with his health circumstances.
There are a few, Your Honor. His health circumstances, one related to health circumstances are invoked generally in the brief. There's an argument related to mental incapacity that was also not raised below. And there's a third argument related to this court's COVID-19 orders, which was not raised below either.
Can I move you on to the merits of this case? Because I got to say, I've got a problem with this.
Yes.
And it's whether it's the reasonable diligence, which bleeds into the extraordinary circumstance, which is, I mean, equitable tolling, the cases kind of provide, you don't have these rigid rules, and mm-hmm. it's on a case by case. And I don't think it's an unfair reading of the record below to say that the suggestion was that unless you do overnight or next day postage, you're going to be out of luck. And so tell me why I'm wrong about that.
Yes, Judge Prost.
That was a pretty rigid rule that seemed to have been applied.
No, and I appreciate this question because it's a very important point given what the Supreme Court has said about case-by-case analysis. So as a first broad principle, there should be no requirement for maximum diligence. The Supreme Court was clear about that in Holland. Nor should there be, and I think this court's precedent in MAPU stands for this position, a rigid comparison of facts from one case to facts from another case. I read the special master and Judge Hertling's decisions below to say that in this case, based on the facts and circumstances present here, the choice to use a guaranteed delivery service would have been a sufficient condition to demonstrate reasonable diligence, but it is not a necessary condition to demonstrate reasonable diligence. There are other things the petitioner could have perhaps done in these same factual circumstances and still achieved reasonable diligence. The special master's decision, I read quite narrowly to say, it would have been sufficient to use an overnight mail delivery service, but there is no requirement from either the special master or the CFC that you must use a guaranteed delivery.
Well, right underneath. So if that's not required, it seems like right underneath that is certified first class mail, which is committed to be delivered between 1 and 5 business days. And here they took well over that. I mean, if they had held to anything close to 1 to 5, if they've held to 1 to 10, he would have been timely. So how is that not sufficient to establish not exemplary diligence, but just reasonable diligence under these circumstances?
So this is a question that's been considered by our sister circuits in several cases. There's four specific ones I would point to that all stand for the general proposition that a delay in the regular mail is well known and not uncommon, but certainly does not arise to extraordinary circumstances. The most helpful case...
That may be true of the word delay, but this was kind of an excessive delay, right? I mean, he filed it, the commitment was 1 to 5 business days, and he filed it, 11 regular days, 8 business days beforehand. There was a cushion that he gave in his filing to allow for things not happening exactly right. So what cases like that? Because I didn't see any on the facts.
I would point this – so that exact timeline, I cannot point to a case.
But it matters. The timeline matters,
sure.
Right? I mean, if it had arrived 4 days after the fact, that would have – that it wasn't really reasonable. He had a cushion in there, even if – Way beyond what they said about 1 to 5 days.
So two points come to mind immediately, Judge Prost. And so the first is the D.C. Circuit in Robinson versus DHS considers somewhat similar circumstances. It's a delay in regular mail in the setting of the COVID-19 pandemic. They join the 6th, 8th, and 11th Circuit we cite in our brief in saying that these delays in mails aren't extraordinary. But I understand your point is about the specific timing of this case. So drilling down into that.
And the fact that it was only 85 miles away. I mean, if mm-hmm. he was filing something to Hawaii, you'd think, well, he should have realized this is a big trip. But this was a close location.
So I think Judge Hertling had these same thoughts you did, and that's reflected in his decision. First, I would point to this. Based on the delivery commitment, which the appellee explained in our brief is very different than a delivery guarantee, and I can speak on that in a moment. The delivery commitment would have had the petition arrive on approximately December 2nd, which was a Friday. That is just 2 business days before the statute of limitation were to expire. So if you look at it from the perspective of, he mailed it on November 26, 2022, between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It was the first Saturday after Thanksgiving. The estimate provided to him by the Postal Service left just about a 48-hour window for the postage or for the package to arrive at the court timely.
Not 48 hours. If you're talking about business days, not 48-hour calendar days.
Correct. So business days, 48 hours. Calendar days, the second was a Friday, and so the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th are the regular days. Judge Hertling's point here was, He agreed with the special master below that it was not diligent to not avail yourself of an overnight delivery service given this 2 business day window. But that is not the end of the analysis because there's no requirement to use overnight mail. Judge Hertling point below was there was tracking information available. The petitioner in this case paid for that tracking information. He had opportunities to exercise diligence after making the initial decision to use certified first-class mail.
I was a little confused by that.
Sure.
Because maybe I don't do this tracking stuff enough, but it seems to me at one point trying to decipher at what point he could have tracked it, even if he were tracking it moment by moment, to make the decision that it's not going to make it there on time. And then he would have had to get together another package and then put it in the overnight mail. And then we have to assume that it would have gotten the next day. I don't see that. That time frame is just too precise. And I guess I'm not. But let me – you can respond to that. But let me just ask you about something else. You seem to distinguish, as the record below did, between the commitment – for the post-regular first-class mail, and the guarantee. Well, the guarantee isn't a guarantee. There's no such thing as a guarantee when using the mail. The guarantee is if it doesn't get there overnight, we'll give you your money back, which doesn't guarantee that the package is going to get there on time. It just guarantees that you'll get a refund, which wouldn't help anybody in this circumstance because it wouldn't have been delivered on time nonetheless. Right?
Well, I think your characterization of the guarantee is correct, but that's still a very important fact. And there's an important factual difference in the body of equitable tolling case law about using the guaranteed delivery. You're absolutely right. No one can guarantee certainty in the future and a certain delivery date. But going back to the common law of contract, when a carrier provides a guarantee, a refundable service if we do not meet the commitment, there is an implication in a guarantee that the carrier, because they have their money on the line, the contract on the line, that they are going to do everything they can to deliver it as quickly as possible. So it's
What's the difference between that and a commitment?
Well, I think that would be a question best answered by the Postal Service.
So it's not reasonable to rely on commitments, but it's reasonable to rely on guarantees?
I think it's more reasonable to rely on a guarantee. I think the special, as I was saying earlier.
Are you familiar with the Supreme Court opinion that was decided last week, a couple weeks ago, called Watson? It dealt with mail-in ballots.
I'm familiar with the upshot, but not the details, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, there was a Mississippi statute which was upheld.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed for, if it's postmarked on election day and it arrives within 5 days afterwards, Mississippi must have therefore made an assumption that regular mail takes 5 days or less, because if you didn't make the 5 days, your ballot wouldn't be counted. So don't you think the state of Mississippi would have necessarily made a reasonable assumption that mail ballots would come in with less than 5 days?
I think in that case, and to draw the analogy here, it's more about the voter, or in this case, the petitioner, doing what they can with the circumstances in their control. The prison mailbox rule does not really apply out of the prison context, and the mailbox rule doesn't really apply in most tort litigation unless it's explicitly in the statute. That was actually a question raised before this court in 2005 in Mapu v. Nicholson, and in that case, and this court declined to apply the mailbox rule to petitions for compensation. But what I would say to answer you, I think the call of your question, Judge Prost, is at the moment when the voter or the petitioner is trying to exercise diligence, what choices have they made? With the mail-in ballot, the voter is trusting the mail, so they were mailed the ballot, they were told to put it back in there. There was no discussion of, hey, you might need to make this specific deadline, so you should go try and do an overnight delivery service. Here, the petitioner was rather sophisticated. He researched and prepared his petition. He made it to the post office. At the post office, he was presented with a certified first-class mail option that would have gotten his petition there just 2 business days, 4 regular days before it was due. He had tracking on that package. The special master says you should have, based on this narrow timeline, chosen overnight delivery. And Judge Hertling clarified that wasn't the be-all, end-all analysis. Even if petitioner had chosen to use first-class certified mail, and this goes back to the tracking point, if I may, Your Honor. My friend on the other side raised the point that if he looked at the tracking, there would have been no indication that there was a problem, because there was an update on November 30th that it was in transit, and then the next update was that it was delivered on the 7th. I think that's respectfully a red herring argument. I think it's a straw man, rather, and I say that with respect but also accuracy. The November 30th on the tracking, that's not a date of any significance. Petitioner was told that based on the delivery window he allegedly relied upon, that it should have been delivered on the 2nd. If he had checked his tracking information on the 2nd, he would have seen it was not delivered and would have been alerted that there was a problem. That's true also if he had tracked it on the 3rd. If on the 3rd he had noticed it had not been delivered, he still had 2 business days to overnight this pack, or 1 business day, 2 regular days to get this package overnighted. Petitioner had additional opportunities.
This package, he would have had to come up with another package.
A new petition for the same claim. Yes, Your Honor, precisely. And that's significant because there are additional steps petitioner could have taken to exercise reasonable diligence. It doesn't, this question doesn't always turn on the choice of delivery service in front of the post office. That's just the first step. Petitioner has also argued that the special master and the court below are requiring more of a maximum diligence standard, but that's not the case either. I don't think the Supreme Court well defines maximum diligence in Holland v. Florida, but what I can offer is there are many other things petitioner could have done if he wanted to guarantee that, to ensure that his petition was timely filed. He could have retained local counsel to file it locally.
That's not your role. It's not the role of the government to make those type of determinations. We have the Vaccine Act. We know what it's used for. We have the law of due diligence and extraordinary circumstances. It seems to me that you want us to create a new creature here that's going to drive all petitions to be filed in the future only using overnight couriers or something and not the U.S. mail. And that doesn't strike me right.
Yes, and Judge Reyna, to your point, I agree that's absolutely not the government's role is to say you should have done all these things. I was raising that as an example of how the court below is not requiring a maximum diligence standard because we can think of additional things that could have been done in furtherance of filing this petition if the requirement was indeed maximum diligence. And to your structural concern.
Do you agree with me that the finding as to this issue we're talking about was a major component in the decision to not allow equitable tolling?
I would agree that the special master did find that the decision to use a non-guaranteed delivery service was extremely significant.
Gave it a lot of weight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Judge Reyna, to your structural concern, I agree with the concern completely, and I do not think that the issue below or the decisions below create such a rule. The special master at appendix six.
Not below us. You're asking us to create a new rule, a special rule. And it seems to me if we follow your argument, that'll at least create that type of effect. Maybe not by fact, but also by spirit, but by law and spirit, it would create that effect.
My time has expired. May I answer?
Oh, please, no. Please.
Judge Reyna, you're correct, and I'm sorry for misframing it. We are asking this court to uphold the decision below. These cases on equitable tolling are always very case by case. They're extremely fact specific. Here, what the government is asking is that given the facts and circumstances of this case, given the fact that certified first-class mail would have left a very small window, that it was not diligent to select that option when other options were readily available. There are other cases where there could have been different circumstances at play. Perhaps
they could have ridden a horse over to the courthouse or something. Yeah, there's other options. I don't see that his selecting the U.S. mail system at that time. Now let's not look at this with hindsight, but at that time, I don't see that having been an unreasonable decision to use the U.S. mail.
I think that the special master below was not alone in concluding that it was based upon the Eighth Circuit, Sixth Circuit, D.C. Circuit, and 11th Circuit, to name the ones we cite in our brief.
Did he cite, did the special master cite any of those?
No, the special master below, she relied upon the Mojica decision and the Raspberry decision, which I think are also instructive on this point as well.
And
those are vaccine cases?
Yes, Your Honor. Both Raspberry and Mojica are, yes.
We may have to reach extraordinary circumstances, so I do want to make sure I understand your view on that. First of all, what about this idea of us remanding it for the Court of Federal Claims to review what the special master said about it in the first instance?
I don't think that would be necessary here or perhaps not even proper, Your Honor. The court could make that decision. Because the facts are not in dispute, this court sits in de novo review, so it sits in the same posture as the Court of Federal Claims reviewing the special master's decision. So this court's free to reach its own conclusions without a remand analysis.
What about the argument that the extraordinary circumstances are shown by a confluence of events, a bunch of things, delays in the mail, plus COVID, plus health, all the things you say, many of them are waived and you may be, or forfeited, and you may be right. But what about the idea of putting them all together? Is that an argument that's properly before us that we can or should reach?
No, Your Honor. I'd like to expand upon that idea if that's permissible. So de novo review is still a type of review. And so any argument not before the special master is not properly before this court. There are two arguments raised regarding extraordinary circumstances that are before this court. The fact that the mail was late, which, as petitioner cited, was happening 12% of the time for 5 to 8 years prior to 2022, and the argument that the COVID-19 pandemic generally impacted the mail. Those are the only arguments properly before this court. And I think that the Supreme Court has been very clear that when you're looking at extraordinary circumstances, the obstacles have to have actually stood in the way of petitioner's filing. And below, and still, even if you consider these waived arguments, there hasn't been a showing that there was something about the COVID-19 pandemic in November of 2022 that prevented petitioner from timely filing his petition.
This may go to whether or not you view it as waiver or forfeiture, but do we have discretion nonetheless to reach these issues and or to remand and tell the Court of Federal Claims to consider maybe giving an opportunity to make these arguments and try to prove them?
I think the court does not have discretion here, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. So first, this court sits in the same posture as the CEFC in this de novo review. So if it's not before this court properly, it's not before the CEFC properly. Second, I think a lot has been said, especially in the last probably 20 years, about the important differences between waiver, a failure to raise an objection or a claim, and a lot's been said of waiver, the intentional relinquishment of a known right or argument, and forfeiture, simply failure to raise an argument at the time. Two points related to this case. One, I think Vaccine Rule 8F relatively elegantly solves that problem. And it says that arguments and facts not before the special master are waived. So I think based on the rules of the vaccine rules that apply, I don't think this court even reaches the forfeiture question. They are waived arguments per the rules of the controlling program. Two, the issue of, for example, the court's rules, that fact is brought up before the special master. It's at footnote 6 of the petitioner's reply to respondent's response. And what's raised in footnote 6 is, by the way, the court rule said we had to use USPS. But if you looked at this through a traditional waiver versus forfeiture framework, that weighs an issue of waiver because it was a known fact at the time and it was not brought up as an extraordinary circumstance. So that's squarely a waived argument. And indeed, the issues related to petitioner's health, surgery, general anesthesia, none of those were properly before this or raised before the special master, so they weren't properly raised before the CEFC or this court.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge Press.
And you're very informative and very helpful to the court. I appreciate the argument.
Thank you very much, Judge Press.
You've got some time. Let me ask you, first of all, when did counsel get involved in this? It was after, so all of the mailing and everything that went down, your client was pro se?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you were hired when he went before the special master?
In November 2023, I think is when I entered this case. He filed his petition about a year before that.
Okay. Well, you might want to start. Your friend referred to this, your client is being pretty sophisticated. He said rather sophisticated. So why don't you start there? I mean, it did seem like he knew what he was doing. He got it together. He sent it pretty early, given the commitment of time frame from 1 to 5 business days.
I think he was reasonably sophisticated. He has at least an undergraduate degree.
I don't want to evaluate him in terms of his degree. So,
I don't think he's been in this program before. I don't want to be like avoidant on it, but I don't know that he was more or less sophisticated than any, you know, other adult who needed to transport things through the mail. He needed a remote commercial mail service option because of his age, the comorbidities, et cetera. So he went to the Cambridge Post Office and mailed.
Do you have any other response to what your friend on the other side said?
Yes. My friend mentions Robinson versus DHS. That case, all the sister court cases, Robinson versus DHS, Talamantes, Penalver, there was a third one, and the Irigoyen versus Holder. Those cases are all distinct because, as you noted, here the petitioner appellant left Buffer he mailed with a timely service commitment of 1 to 5 days. Those cases, the parties in those cases mailed either without enough time for the service commitment to be fully fulfilled and expire, or the mailing was 1 day after the commitment. And that's not the case here. To respond to Judge Stark, petitioner's age and health was mentioned below, argued below. I believe it was briefed below. I would point to Appendix 62 and Appendix at 83. I do believe it was raised there.
In the context of extraordinary circumstances.
It was in a context of reasonable diligence, which was within his control. And, I think petitioner's read is reasonable diligence is what's in his control. Extraordinary circumstances was external to him. So, petitioner read the reasonable diligence prong as what did he have control over, overcoming his health circumstances and getting to the post office with a timely commitment was certainly squarely within his control. I guess the last thing I'll say is to the intermittent mental capacity. I will concede that my reading of the case law highlighted that there is a, like as the court applied this test in KG and as a sister court in Harper versus Urkel applied the test, there's a causal link problem between the surgery in 2021 and the end of the statute of limitation in 2022. In the Harper versus Urkel case, the gentleman was hospitalized through the end of the tolling period. So, as you pointed out, Judge Stark, I am making an argument that the combination of circumstances was what actually conspired to make his filing untimely.
Any response to the fact? To the argument that that's waived under the vaccine rules?
Yes, Your Honor. I thought the citation was an interactive gift case. I actually don't think that's accurate. But there's a case that suggests the issues get waived. All the issues were raised below. There were two issues, reasonable diligence and extraordinary circumstances. So those were raised. And the arguments on those issues can be forfeited. And my read was that's within the discretion of the court to decide whether they'll reach those issues or whether they're forfeited. So I would say that Petitioner Chilik did address those issues below. They were briefed below, and the forfeiture matter is the discretion of the panel.
Thank you. We thank both sides. The case is submitted. These are proceeding for this morning.